is Rhode Island's longest-running financial talk show, Money Talk with Don Soa. With market insights and so much more, talk to Don now at 437-5000 or 1-888-345-0790. This is Money Talk with Don Soa.
And we welcome you to the Money Talk program, everybody. I'm Don Soa. Glad to have you here on a Thursday afternoon. This is AM 790, your home of talk and business, and we're clearing out another week here in the world of money and finance and looking at all those things that move your markets up and down. You know, after an extraordinary day yesterday, I suppose it made some sense that we'd see a little bit of a pullback in the market today. So equities did close a bit lower. Financials lagged as one sector. Social media company Snap, however, had a strong performance in its initial public offering, its IPO. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell about 100 points about 20 minutes before the close. It broke below that level, with Caterpillar contributing probably the most to that loss. Caterpillar stock declined more than 4% after law enforcement officials went in there searching their offices. Art Hogan, who's a chief market strategist at Wunderlich Securities, said that he's not worried about this particular decline. He says he'd be more concerned if, after being up 300 points yesterday, if we were up another 100 points today. He says pulling back a couple of, 100 points or so is not a big issue, especially when you had an unusual, maybe even unjustified run-up yesterday. The S&P 500 declined about 0.64%, with financials declining more than 1% of that group. And the NASDAQ composite was down about 0.8%. As most commentators will suggest, it's only normal where you have record levels, and at some point it's natural to see some profit-taking come in. Investors are always looking for an opportunity actually to take some money off the table, but one of the great fears that investors share at that same time is missing out on upside opportunity. So, yeah, you want to take some money off the table, but God forbid you're out of position when the market continues to move higher and you're sitting in cash. That's a judgment call, and I think you can't have regrets. You have to have a strategy of your own. You have to have an entry point, understand what you're buying, why you own them, and then maybe make a decision early on as to when you'll actually pull out. One very good strategy would be for those who buy individual stocks where this is a possibility is to say, look, I'm going to buy this stock, and if by chance it doubles in value, at the point where it doubles in value, I'm either going to sell my position then or do what I kind of like to do with these active, high, fast-moving growth stocks is to say, if it doubles in value, simply take half of the money off the table. Basically, play with the house's money, so to speak. If you went in and you invested $10,000 and it has now grown to $20,000, take $10,000 off and either hold it in cash and wait for a great opportunity to buy something really at a very low price that you like, or take the money off and use it as the seed money for the next phase of your investment strategy and leave in place $10,000 that you earned. As like I said, playing with the house's money. At that stage of the game, regardless of what the market does, you can't lose money. You took your initial principal, you went in, you doubled your value, and then you took the profits off the table, and then your initial principal is equal to your gain. And again, even if you lost all of it, you still had your initial principal someplace else, and you're now taking another different set of risks. Snap, the parent company for social media platform Snapchat, they saw its stock rise more than 50% after opening for trade today, pushing it well above the $17 a share that it priced at in the IPO. Investors eagerly awaiting the IPO as they looked for some clues on the health of the technology IPO market. I mean, given all the negatives associated with this particular company, it's going to be one of the most interesting stories we'll see, at least over the next few days, according to Maris Ogg, who's with Tower Bridge Advisors. Snap entered public market a day after the three major U.S. stock indices posted their best session of the year on the back of Donald Trump's speech to Congress. This is still not the major optimism we need at a top. A lot of people are looking for whether we are at a top or not, and should that be the driving force to get you to readjust your portfolios. But I think, you know, there aren't too many more feel-good speeches out there that the president can give, especially speeches that he can give without specifics. I think more analysts and more traders are saying, okay, you know, the big picture, broad picture type of speeches that are designed to, you know, rah-rah your base. I mean, this is no longer the campaign. He's now the president of the United States. We're looking to see what the specifics are, because until we see the specifics, we're not going to have any idea of what it's going to take for Congress. And remember, who's Congress? Well, they're the guys that have to pay for all these brilliant ideas. Now, some of the president's ideas may be, in fact, wonderful, but they all have to be funded. They have to be paid for. And until we see the specifics on any of them, there's very little sense of whether the leadership in the Senate, or in Paul Ryan in the case of the House, whether they're going to be inclined to want to do what may be the very, very difficult, painful decisions of raising the capital, raising the money that's necessary to make the Trump campaign promises actually come true, even if they happen to be campaign promises that the House ultimately likes. You have to remember something. Paul Ryan came out of the whole Tea Party environment years ago. John Boehner lost his job because he wasn't a fiscal conservative enough, according to the folks in the Tea Party. So that said, they still exist. The fact that you didn't hear the term Tea Party that often, it doesn't much matter. These are ultra-conservatives. They're going to be fiscal conservatives. And they're going to be looking for how you pay for everything. They're also going to be looking for smaller government. Right now, the early first several weeks of the Trump administration is not making them feel warm and fuzzy in terms of their priority for smaller government. They want to move more money from the federal government, more responsibility and power from the federal government over to the states. States' rights types issues dominate that debate. Again, we will see how that shakes out. But like as you said, if the president and his people can start putting some meat on the bone and presenting it to Congress and to the public for discussion and for analysis, there's a better chance that some of these bills, whether it deals with tax reform, whether it deals with regulation, changes in regulatory regime, or whether it deals with infrastructure spending. I mean, all of those things are possible, but we have to know how big a plan the plan will be, what will it potentially cost, and where can we get the money to do it. We're finding now, and the president will find very quickly, that there's something that we've talked about a number of times here on this Money Talk program, and that is linkage, the term linkage. One plan, one proposal, one bill presented to Congress, many times they do not stand alone. The decision will not be stood all by itself. Many times one bill is attached to another bill, is attached to another program, and the spending or the revenues generated by any one of them are dependent one to the other. It's linkage. They don't stand alone. After rising, you know, we've seen a lot of rising expectations for a Federal Reserve raising their Fed fund rate this month. That's amid a combination of stronger economic data that we've seen and some hawkish rhetoric from key officials that are out there. Most recently, Fed Governor Lyle Brainard, who's a known dove in the central bank's monetary policy committee, he said Wednesday, the Fed could raise rates soon, citing an improved global economy. We're closing in on full employment. Inflation is moving gradually toward our targets. Foreign growth is on more solid footing. And risks to the outlook are as close to balanced as they have been in a long, long, long time. Fed Governor Jerome Powell also said that the case for a rate increase in the month of March has started to come together. So don't be shocked if in this March meeting we do see a quarter point move on the Fed fund rate, bringing it up to 0.75%. Market expectations for a March rate hike are right around 80%, according to the CME Group's FedWatch tool. That's pretty high. The Fed finally is on board that the economy is doing fine, and that's a positive overall for Wall Street. Wall Street doesn't like them raising rates. They don't like them increasing the cost of money. But if they're absolutely convinced, and they know that the Fed economists are convinced that this economy is comfortable and standing on both feet comfortably and can stand on its own merits, they will view that as a good opportunity for the increased value of stocks. and the increased value in corporate earnings. In economic news, we did see initial U.S. jobless claims total about 223,000, which is well below the expected 243,000. Last week's reading increased 6,000 to about 244,000. So a reduction in jobless claims is certainly going to be one indicator that shows the economy is cranking on all cylinders. During the president's speech, he said something to the tune of about 85 million people in the United States who are no longer in the workforce. I don't know how to put it. That's a really, really distorted, confusing number for most people. That doesn't mean that there are 85 million unemployed people. If that were the basis for unemployment, we would have an unemployment rate of a 48% unemployment rate. Our unemployment rate is down well below 6%, historically low. Because, as it turns out, the 85 million he was talking about, they involve a lot of people, including some people who are retired, people who are disabled and no longer working. It's not an issue of weak. The expectation when you make a statement like that is that you're talking about, well, because we're in such a dismal, terrible economy, that we have this many people who are not working. Well, a large number of them are working because they can't, not because they don't want to, not because they don't have a job, but there may be medical reasons why they're not working. There's a number of issues that are all part of that mix overall, and some of it is because some of them are students and they're simply too tied up with getting their education to be able to actually work full-time, which makes a good deal of sense. U.S. Treasury yields did rise, two-year note hitting a fresh 2009 high from 2009. The 10-year note reached the highest level we've seen since February 16th. Dow Jones Industrial Average was last down 66 points or 0.31 to 21,053, with Caterpillar leading the decline over the course of that mix, but of course finished up, like I said, in a slightly better picture. The S&P 500 dropped 10 points, 0.43%, closing at 23.85. Financials leading the seven sectors lower. Utilities were outperforming. And the NASDAQ declined about 28 points. That's 0.48%, coming at around 58.75. For every three stocks declined for every advancer at the New York Stock Exchange. Numbers, you know, they're interesting and fascinating. But one of the things that people start to look at now, it's not that general sense that, you know, you can't invest necessarily in everything and everything will rise. There are things that, as we are now in a new administration, looking to the prospects for a new or evolving economy, investors are going to have to start saying, well, okay, with the P.E. ratios up around 20 or 21 in a market, using the Dow Jones as an indicator, up above, 21,000 in over 2350 on the S&P, we do see upside potential there. There are a number of people who feel we're seeing targeted numbers for the S&P hitting 2,500 by year end. That would be a move of at least another 5% from where we are right now. And where we are right now is between 5 and 7%. You know, so this may be the year potentially, and not guaranteed, but potentially this is the year the market could be up 10 or 12% for the year. Even though we have told you on this program many, many times that, you know, those kind of numbers will be ultimately unrealistic. I'm Don So. We're going to take a break. We'll start talking about some specific sectors of the market which may have upside potential under a Trump administration. I'm Don. We'll be back with more on AM 790's Money Talk. And we welcome you back to the Money Talk program. Okay, so it's a brand new year. The elections are over. Inauguration's done. President's been sitting in place doing his thing for a couple of months now. And he's putting in a lot of hours. He's been putting in a lot of time. But even from his own perspective, strangely enough, aside from trying to get members of his cabinet approved, a lot of the executive orders that he's been signing, that kind of stuff is the easy stuff because it's stuff he can do. It's stuff he can do on his own. Now, granted, it still requires that he does some homework and get some good advice on them. Otherwise, it can make him look bad. It does tend to paint a picture, trying to look at the trends that he's focusing his attention on, and it does look like a lot of the stuff he signed as executive orders are really just things intended to reverse executive orders that were written by the Obama administration, by President Obama. But now the real stuff comes in. Now the point comes in where instead of being, you know, when you're signing executive orders, you kind of feel like the CEO of the United States, which is something I'm sure that Donald Trump is comfortable with and he loves doing. But now he's going to have to govern, because now most of what he has to do, most of the big things, by the way, most of the things that are ultimately elements of the promises that he made during his campaign involve him presenting bills to Congress and getting approval from Congress for those bills. This is where the tough stuff comes in. This is where, now, if he's the ultimate negotiator, if he's the deal maker, this is where you're going to start negotiating. This is where compromise, one of the words I know that he hates, but this is where compromise is going to have to start coming in. He's going to have to start figuring out how to pay for a large number of the things that he wants. And more importantly, and here's the hard part, he's going to have to start thinking about things he's willing to give up or trim back on, put, in other words, focus less attention on, less emphasis, to get those things which are, in his mind, absolutely critical. Again, so he's going to have to start prioritizing, and that means even the things that he wanted to push during the campaign, promises he wanted to make at that time, he may find he's, because he can't do everything, because he can't pay for everything, he's going to have to prioritize and decide, you know, which of them he wants most. Which ones does he feel are probably most important to the American people? And to the legacy, of course, that he's going to try to create for himself. Industrial stocks have been sort of the toast of the town. They've been the toast of Wall Street ever since President Donald Trump's election. Industrial stocks. People have bought up a lot of industrials broadly, and they did so on the hopes of a number of big things like infrastructure spending. That's a big deal. He's talking about over $1 trillion being spent in order to accommodate the infrastructure needs of the country. By the way, I don't think anybody's going to argue that there's massive infrastructure need. There's a need for major infrastructure focus and attention. If done properly, it could create jobs, and it certainly will help to make the United States a more attractive environment for business of all kinds. Roads, bridges, telecommunications, you know, resource treatment, electrical, telecommunications, you name it. A lot of projects that go into that mix, and I would imagine even something as mundane as the border wall is all part of infrastructure. Now, whether that's a major priority or not, whether you need to build and repair bridges and dams and water treatment systems, if that's more important than building a wall, again, that may be part of that kind of a discussion. That's something the president has to consider, and that's where the big debate will be, where the negotiations will be. But industrial stocks include more than simply construction, and they have just as much to offer, interestingly enough. Infrastructure falls into the category of defense, transportation, even water-related companies, water treatment, water processing. They've all have massive upside potential from an investment perspective this year. Now, how would you, or how would most people, want to dip your foot into the waters, shall we say, of infrastructure spending, dip into the water of industrial companies? Well, there are a number of funds. We call them ETFs or exchange-traded funds, and they can be really highly focused. Yep, an ETF can obviously be a basket of that matches the S&P 500, so there's an S&P 500 ETF. They can match any broad index like that. They can also be really specific. We know ETFs out there that will buy nothing but South Korean companies, nothing but companies from Argentina or Germany. In other words, these are country funds, but they buy a basket that's representative of the economy and the markets of a particular country or a particular sector. You could say healthcare, but maybe that's even broader than you need to be. How about just biotech companies, just pharmaceutical companies? Those are all tranches or baskets of that are part of an ETF. So exchange-traded funds provide several different ways, of course, to play this space. You can go with broad-based exposure, like I mentioned, to sort of tactical plays. So now you're looking, yes, at those sectors, yes, the industrialized sector, but now you're going to be looking at those sectors that have the highest potential industries. So I'm going to be spending a little bit of time here talking about the different opportunities you have and some particular exchange-traded funds that deal with these particular types of issues. Now, that said, we're not giving investment advice here. Why is that? Because I don't know who's listening. The particular exchange-traded funds I mention here might be perfectly suited to some of you. And for others, they may not be. This is informational. It's educational. Letting you know, just explaining to you what an ETF is supposed to be educational. It's not saying go out and buy ETFs. But one thing that people do like about ETFs, in many cases, is that they are, by comparison to other types of funds, they are very, very low cost for the most part. But no, like other funds, they are not all created equal. Now, there's a fund out there. Now, this is more of an industrial, broader-based fund. It's called the Industrial Select Sector SPIDR Fund. SPDR is SPIDR. The symbol is XLI for industrial. Now, this is a very low-cost fund. It's a no-load buy. Now, if you're buying it in your brokerage account, whatever the cost of that trade is what you're spending, Schwab or Fidelity or online trading services. I mean, we're talking, you heard the commercials on TV, you know, well, how much are you charging per trade? Well, I don't know that that's really the focus that most people should worry about. How about $6.95 a trade? How about $5.95? That type of debate. Obviously, you're not getting advice from your broker. It's just somebody who's executing a trade, and that's fine. And you should quibble a little bit about the price and go with the lowest cost provider with a high quality, dependable company. Yes. Well rated, of course. But mutual funds, including exchange-traded funds, have internal expenses. These are expenses that are related to what happens inside the fund, the placement of all of the various companies. Remember, the fund is buying and selling occasionally individual companies that meet the criteria of the basket that you're creating. XLI is a select sector fund. It's got an expense ratio of 0.14%. That means the annual cost of the fund is about $14 to you, the investor, for every $10,000 you're investing. 0.14% or 14 basis points is very, very, very low. Pretty good. It means you get to keep most of anything you earn if you have a good year. I like that. If your trading expenses are also low, then you win. It's not what you make that matters. It's what you keep that counts, right? So this is an industrial fund. It's the most popular way to invest in this target sector. It's huge. It's a $11 billion portfolio. And literally, it dwarfs the next largest fund, Vanguard. Vanguard's industrial ETF is VIS, a good one. It's perfectly fine. But it's about a $3 billion ETF. The ETF provides broader exposure to American firms across several industries, though it does lean heaviest on aerospace and defense companies. 22%, like Boeing, industrial conglomerates are in there too, such as General Electric, which itself makes up about 9% of the fund. XLI also holds machinery and road and rail and airlines and building product companies, among others. So that's a good way to start with a real broad-based industrial ETF. We got more to talk about in this sector. We're going to be talking about other ETFs, some of them a lot more specific than XLI. I'm Don Sowa. This is Money Talk. We'll be right back. And we welcome you back to the second half of tonight's program. We're talking about specific sectors because we get a lot of requests here on the show and off air, and sometimes even through on our website, people will call and say, hey, why don't you talk about some of the areas in particular that we can make money in due to the Trump presidency? People are saying, well, the broad-based Trump trade, what they call the Trump rally, is what's causing this these moves of the market since November the 8th to where we are now, breaking through 21,000 on the Dow. But that's a broad-based trade. That's sort of across the board. We're talking about, given that there are certain key sectors of the economy that probably will participate more than others, of course, you know, in a, well, I don't know how to put this, in trying to be apolitical a little bit. It's a, if the president and his staff, his people are successful in pushing through certain key elements of his agenda, shall we say, such as deregulation in certain areas of the economy, including financials and energy and a bunch of other places, deregulation. He's made a point. He's saying that in each department, each cabinet department, he wants to have a team inside each of those sectors looking at areas where there's excess redundant and expensive regulation that they feel is not helpful or certainly, you know, hurting productivity and hurting profitability and hurting efficiencies within those departments. I mean, there's a sensibility to that logic. I mean, it comes right down to it. The care has to be taken. And I say this all the time, but I mean, there are always some regulations that are wasteful and they're overkill. And yeah, they cost money, they're costly, and they hurt profits, and that's not good. But don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. There are some critical regulations that are there for good reason, and they're supposed to be. And enforcing and safeguarding those regulations and making them work efficiently is also part of the job of each of the president's cabinet secretaries. Tax reform is a big deal, 80,000 plus pages of the tax code. I would imagine there's an awful lot of work that can be done there in order to bring the onerous nature of tax issues down. We have to make our taxes more competitive globally. We got to bring money from overseas that, if brought in now, if repatriated, would be subject to a 35% tax. It's got to come down to a much, much more reasonable tax level, maybe 20%, maybe less, but 20 I think is reasonable. But it's got to be done. Otherwise, corporations that have global businesses will say, fine, I'm going to leave my money overseas. I can use it in the foreign markets. I don't need to bring it back to the U.S. Even though some very, very large profitable growth companies are out there generating a large part, maybe even a majority of their business now outside the U.S., they're not going to be inclined to take that majority of their profits and bring it back to the U.S. with a reasonable amount of it taxed so that we could generate money for the Treasury and help to finance a lot of these programs that the president's so concerned about. So tax reform is a big deal, and that can be done. And these are things that probably can be done with the support of the existing leadership in Congress. They're not inconsistent with traditional conservative Republican philosophy, you know? There are some other things that are going to be problematic. I think infrastructure spending is a big deal. We're talking about it now. Will there be more infrastructure spending under the Trump administration? Of course there will be. And I think there will be because there's a general consensus, I think, among most parties, whether you're a Democrat, whether you're you think you're a progressive, if you're a Tea Party type, or you are a moderate. I think that, you know, we need to spend money to take a country as growth and dramatic and advanced as we are in the United States, and realize that traveling the airports of other countries, even the Asian markets and everywhere else, they're extraordinary modern airports. Yet here in the U.S., you go through some of our airports, boy, I'll tell you, our airports are in tough shape. Have you gone to LaGuardia? LaGuardia Airport is nuts. It's just nuts. But money will be spent. There will be key sectors where that money will be spent. There will be certain companies that will be the primary beneficiaries of that spending. So we're looking at the industrial sector, and we've been looking in the last segment I started out talking about industrial-based exchange-traded funds that you might be interested in. Now, I mentioned XLI, which is a broad-based industrial, one of the largest $11 billion portfolio, a lot of U.S.-based companies. Now, there's another exchange-traded fund called IPN, N as in Norman. It stands for it's the International Industrial Sector Fund. The IPN essentially is the international version of the XLI. And if you're looking for sort of geographical diversification, not having all of your eggs in one basket in the U.S., it's sort of a better way to go other than using, say, a global fund that tends to be much more heavily weighted in American exposure. That said, IPN, the country holdings, they're not really level. They're not really as well balanced as I might like. Japan makes up about 34% of the ETF's assets. The U.K. and France are weighted at about 10% each. A lot of machinery companies like Japan's Fanuc Corporation are the largest weights, nearly 18%. Conglomerates such as Germany's Siemens makes up about 11%. Road and rail and trading companies, distributors, they're right in that 10% weighting themselves as well. But again, it's a way to mix up. I wouldn't blend IPN equally to XLI. But again, not a bad mix in the broad-based categories. Now, there are a number, as we get into key markets where you see like China and others, where there seems to be a lot of activity going on there, there's CHII. Now, CHII is the Chinese industrial mix. Their data kicked off back, it was right around this year, around 2017, but the holdings holding IPN wouldn't know that if you look at that, you wouldn't really know that the country is represented at a mere 0.4% of the ETF's assets for IPN. So if you want a little bit of exposure to China, you're probably going to have to go into more of a Chinese-related fund like CHII. More expensive than the others, 0.65% or 65 basis points. That's a little more for an ETF, but it's a specialized area, such as China, you know, trying to go in and selectively pick the right Chinese companies. Investors have a direct option in the Global X China Industrial ETF, which holds about 40 of the sort of the Middle Kingdom's industrial stocks. The fund's breakdown is much more rudimentary than the S&P's. It has machinery and equipment, building and construction, transportation and automobiles, and components are held kind of at a 35, 34, 27, 4% split. Investors should be aware, though, that CHII does hold some, this is, you've got to be aware of this, some state-owned, Chinese state-owned companies, including the China Railway Construction Corporation and China State Construction International, which come with their own advantages maybe in some areas, but they also come with their own very unique risks. Another category may be in the First Trust RBA American Industrial Renaissance ETF, AIRR. Now, it's a 0.7%, a 70 basis point expense ratio. So, yeah, we're getting up a little more expensive, but probably a lot less expensive than if you bought this as an actively managed fund. If you want a straightforward allocation to smaller industrials, smaller companies, a fund like the PowerShares S&P Small Cap Industrials portfolio, that one would be PSCI, that might fit the bill. But FIDU, it has an interesting twist. It invests roughly 90% of its funds in the Russell 2500 small and mid-cap manufacturing category, as well as some other industrial stocks. However, FIDU invests up to 10% in banking stocks in states that are considered to be traditionally manufacturing hubs. Now, knowing that if manufacturing and industrials are doing well, then those banks that are attached to those companies or do a lot of business with them will benefit from it. I don't like to make that play. I'd rather go directly with a banking ETF or a financial services ETF rather than going into an industrial fund that has some money exposed to banks. But anyway, you get some top holdings like truck and trailer product specialists, Wabash National, the generator firm Generac Holdings, but also some small weights for the likes of Indiana Financial Old National Bank Corp. Again, I'm not a great believer in that specifically. But again, you're focusing on specific sectors that you think may benefit. And yeah, you can notice from the tone that we're getting, we've gotten away from some of the bigger pictures like XLI, an $11 billion portfolio. And now we're looking, there's funds out there like PPA. It's an ETF that deals with aerospace and defense portfolios exclusively. And yeah, if infrastructure spending and spending on military defense may suddenly make something like PPA look more attractive. Again, not cheap, 0.64% internal expenses, but again, not too bad. But the PPA, among other things, is a solid play on, of course, the president's policies, specifically making our military strong again. And that's the whole discussion we're having here right now, isn't it? Talking about things that have the potential to do well under a Trump administration. We'll talk a little bit about PPA, the aerospace and defense portfolio, right after this quick break when we come back. So stick around. This is Don Sowa. This is Money Talk. Yeah, we're talking about specific sectors of the market that have the potential, and please, we'll use the word potential carefully, because the markets, no matter what happened in the past in any of these investments, or you can't use that as a guarantee for future performance. It doesn't work that way. And by the way, this whole discussion is about expectation, right? People speculating about which areas of the market will potentially do well if the Trump administration is able to propose to execute and to fund properly some of the key programs that have been that are part of their agenda. That's the issue. So we're identifying, obviously, issues within the infrastructure category, defense category, which are basically industrials. And I obviously, here's one, a real focused area is aerospace and defense. And PPA is the symbol, the ticker symbol, for an exchange-traded fund that deals in that particular area. Now, this fund is focused, as I said, on aerospace and defense. Most of the aerospace companies do have some military ties, obviously. Boeing, which produces crafts such as the B-52 and the CH-47 Chinook. These are the helicopters, the 64, the Apache, and the unmanned liquid hydrogen-fueled Phantom I. Naturally, PPA, the ETF, also includes the usual suspects in the defense category like General Dynamics and Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman. But it also holds companies like cybersecurity firm FireEye and materials Stockball, BLL, which also produces spacecraft and related products. So it's a broad-based pick. Some of these ETFs will have anywhere from 50 to 100, sometimes bigger, depends on the size of the portfolio, different holdings inside the plan. Another area that may be in the ETF category of transportation, IYT is the symbol of the ETF. The iShare IYT is the name, as it would suggest, tracks the Dow Jones Transportation Average. Now, the broader transportation industry is broken down into five sub-industries for the for IYT's purposes. Air freight and logistics is 28%, railroads 23%, airlines 23%, trucking about 19%, marine 7%. That said, IYT is far from diverse. Those five sub-industries cover all of 20 stocks in what is a very top-heavy fund. FedEx, for example, is the top dog at more than 12% weighting in IYT. And the top five holdings make up about 40% of the ETF's assets. So this is, like I said, not highly diverse specific weightings. And I'm not making a judgment or saying anything bad about FedEx. I'm just letting you know that it's not like you're getting 1% average weighting in maybe 100 different companies. And I'm not saying it should be that way, but that's just the way that it is. Now, before we close out tonight's show, there's one area, another area I want to talk about in this area of infrastructure, because I think it's going to become critically important moving forward. And that's the area of water, global water. Guggenheim actually has a global water index, believe it or not. Standard & Poor's runs, handles the index. The symbol for the ETF that tracks the Guggenheim Global Water Index is CGW. A growing global population obviously is helping to spur rapidly climbing demand. An IIASA Water Futures and Solutions study says global water demand could double by 2050. It's dynamic. This dynamic means that big things for companies that supply water, the ones that produce the kind of water infrastructure, moving water around, filtration, desalinization, you name it. Any companies that create technology to conserve and purify water. That means holdings such as Switzerland's Geberit, which produces plumbing and sanitary supplies, as well as U.S. water utility American Waters Works, AWK. Guggenheim's CGW is a global fund, so they're going to have companies from all over, including the U.S., weighting U.K. stocks at 15% and Swiss companies at 9%. But there's a big movement in those particular areas. But the U.S. does loom large. About 45% of the portfolio are highly innovative U.S. technology companies that focus on water. Another area you don't want to forget about is artificial intelligence and robotics. There's a fund, how about this for a ticker symbol, BOTZ, BOTS. While the term robotics, artificial intelligence, and bots conjure up images of technology companies, certainly, this ETF plays at the intersection of technology as well as industrials, where things like industrial automation and autonomous vehicles come to the forefront. Bots is a thin, you know, is a thin things like industrial automation, you know, is a thin 28 stock portfolio. It's not broad. Of industrials that include machinery, about 30%, electronic equipment and instruments, about 11%, healthcare equipment, interestingly, but that's in robotics, right? 10% surgical equipment, among other segments. Top holdings are on the cutting edge, such as Mitsubishi Electronics, 8.5%, Manufacturing Robots, or ABB, that's about 7.5%, and it's industrial automation in power grid technology using robotics. That's all big stuff. These are all critical areas that are going to be important to you. And if you want to focus on drones, I had somebody ask about this specifically, drone technology. Believe it or not, there's an ETF called iFly, I-F-L-Y, and it's an admittedly fast and loose, you know, translation of the idea of an industrial ETF, of course, but incorporating several technology companies, and its aim is, to provide investors with a way to play the up-and-coming drone industry. It's worryingly top-heavy in some very small companies such as AeroVironment, AVAV, and Francis Parrot, Parrot, 9.6% of the portfolio. Moreover, it holds a tech company such as GoPro, which you're familiar with the camera technology, which has really only scratched the drone surface and still is primarily an action camera company. It hasn't done all that well since its IPO, but it's an important developing company. However, while volatile, iFly, I-F-L-Y, its 44-holding portfolio should broadly benefit from a large 57% exposure to, again, the defense sector. Big, big issues. I mean, so this is where you go. These are the areas that when people ask, where do you think, you know, we're going to deal possibly well? All of them, and maybe a sidebar would be shipping. A shipping ETF, SEA is the symbol on it. Take a look at it. Because everything that you develop, everything you make, everything you produce has to be shipped around the world. These are major shipping companies that focus that area. That's SEA. Again, this is not advice. It's information and education, but it's something for you to look into. And if you're interested, ask your financial advisor about what we talked about on tonight's program. Hey, I'm Don Sowa. This is Money Talk. Have a great evening and tune in tomorrow at 5. Steve Bovee will be here with more Money Talk. Have a good night.